I'm Mary Harris. I am filling in today for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking with Jaron Lanier about his new book, Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. And I want to take us back because in 1989, New York Times wrote this article referring to artificial reality, and they described a future where people might, quote unquote, wear a special helmet and gloves to feel immersed in a three-dimensional computer-generated world. This article almost 30 years ago also mentioned a young programmer named Jaron Lanier and said he'd become a guru of this movement. And that's you. And so I'm so pleased to have you here to talk a little bit about what's happened in the last 30 years. You were really there for the birth of Silicon Valley, and you even coined the phrase virtual reality.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you. I mean, I guess I'm curious how being at the birth of this movement and this place shapes how you see what we do every day, the computers that we carry around in our pockets and have on our desktops.
Well, I guess the benefit you get from having been around at the start of something like Silicon Valley and our gadget-based world is that it gives you this perspective that things could have been different than they are. It doesn't feel so inevitable. And what I realize is that there are some ways that things are better than they might have been, actually. We did some things pretty well, but also we see the mistakes. You know, I can see the failings, I think, more clearly than someone who just came into it more recently. And to whom it just feels natural, just like a, you know, just like a natural forest or something.
What kind of failings are you talking about?
Well, we're going to dive right into the negative stuff. I sort of feel like it feels like the whole world's disintegrating right now. And I want to say something positive, but let's go there because it actually relates to the way the rest of the world is disintegrating. So one example of something that went really wrong is back in around the 1980s, there was this tremendous upwelling of feeling that everything should be free in the information world. And it had a kind of a leftist idealism to it. It would be the ultimate socialism in a way. It would be like everyone would have free access to information, free access to creativity, free access to distribution. Everything would be totally open.
Sounds kind of good to me.
Well, it sounded really good back then, I'll tell you. And at times I supported it. But then there was this other thing we also wanted. We also really believed in our entrepreneur heroes. We really worshiped people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and this idea of the hero capitalist who would go out there and just change the world through sheer will, this kind of cross between Adam Smith and Nietzsche or something like that. There was this mythology that really took hold of people. And the thing is, if you combine those two desires, if you say we want everything to be free, and then we also want to have capitalism, not government, we want to have entrepreneur heroes, well, then there's only one solution, which is the advertising model, where you get things for free, but it's paid for by advertising. But then there's a problem with that, which is because computers get more and more sophisticated, and they connect to you more and more, and they know more and more about you. What used to be advertising turns into behavior modification feedback. So it turns into this much, much different thing, which is really creepy. And that's the world we've entered into. And that's unquestionably our biggest mistake.
Well, that's so interesting because, I mean, you're a virtual reality specialist, but I wonder how you think about tools like Facebook and Twitter. Like, and I don't think most people think of them as virtual reality, but I'm wondering if you do.
Well, the way I've been thinking about it lately is that we can think of ourselves as lucky. And I have to say right now, it feels like I have to grasp at any positivity here. So just bear with me.
Go for it, man. We need it.
But we should think of ourselves as lucky that we're dealing with things like manipulated elections and digital addictions while the technology is still so crude. So, you know, because someday it'll become...
Because we have a chance to change it.
Yeah, we have a chance to change it while it's not yet so powerful that it'll overwhelm us. So, you know, but someday it'll become much more compelling and we better figure it out before then.
So you're saying act now.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to go back because I want to talk a little bit about you. Your book is really personal. You talk about your childhood. You are, you know, one of the architects of what's become the internet. But were you raised around a lot of technology?
Sorry. I mean, if you read the book, so the book's The Dawn of the New Everything, you'll see, in a funny way, I was, and in a funny way, I profoundly was not. I grew up in a really odd way. My mom had been the breadwinner, not my dad, which was super unusual in her generation. And she was a concentration camp survivor. She died when I was little in a car accident, and she left us really impoverished. So my dad and I were living in tents, actually, in the desert, and we gradually built a house. Now, this desert happened to be in southern New Mexico, and it happened to also be close to White Sands Missile Range, where the first atomic weapons were tested, and which had an amazing population of engineers and scientists and a really good local university, New Mexico State University. So crazily, in the middle of nowhere, there was also this little technical utopia, and I latched onto it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, didn't you design your own house as a kid?
Yeah. My dad let me design this crazy spaceship-like house when I was 11. And we built it together. It took 7 years. And part of it collapsed a few decades later with him inside, but he survived. And it's just, so, I mean, it's cool to let your 11-year-old design a house, but it's also maybe not the wisest thing. I currently have my own 11-year-old.
Yeah. Would you let her design a house?
I let her design a window in our new house extension.
But just keep it smaller.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, like there's some kind of middle ground there.
Yeah, I mean, your childhood seems like kind of improvisation. I wonder how did you get to Silicon Valley, get to college, get to all those things?
Well, I actually ended up in college really young because I would have died in high school. It was just like a really rough world.
You would have died in high school.
Well, in my elementary school, some of the cowboy kids ganged up and drowned another kid and got away with it because he was of Mexican origin. Chicano, as we called.
And so you were bullied as well.
Oh, yeah. No, it was actually a dangerous place. There were people, oh my God, there used to be shootouts in the barn near where we lived, all kinds of things. And it was a dangerous place, yeah. And you know, I was an eccentric, weird, bright kid, and I started college early, and it saved my life. There's just no question of it.
How did you get there?
Well, see, this is this might be yet another public disclosure of a certain degree Well, you know.
Do it.
Well, I had been in a college summer program when I was 14, which was totally legitimate. But then I just kind of signed up for college classes and stayed on in a way that might have not been totally by the book.
It was a while ago. I think. Yeah. What happened?
Well, I don't think they're going to come for me now. I've been invited back to speak at the school. I think they'll let me get away with it. Oh, I did. You know, it was great. Actually, it was wonderful for me. It was an amazing experience. It was. This was in the early to mid 70s, and computer graphics was just starting to be a little more accessible. And I was in an ideal place with a wonderful math department, and. I was such a strange kid, though. I remember discovering the first articles by Ivan Sutherland. He's the founder of computer graphics, more or less, and he also made the first virtual reality headset.
And you found this in college?
Yeah, I found it when I was about 15, and I was so excited. There wasn't an internet, so you couldn't just sort of find people online. So I'd run up to strangers in the street out in the desert sun and say, "Look at this article about this amazing thing." And I had no idea who these people were, and they were, of course, invariably, you know, either embarrassed or horrified by this strange person with strange hair running up to them, waving this computer science journal in their faces. But that, yeah, I was a kind of an awkward
kid. You were like
kid.
A visitor from the future.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment if our future turns out well. So let's make it turn out well.
I'm Mary Harris. I'm filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Jaron Lanier. He's the author of The Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. So you're describing this amazing background. And then how did that inform your approach to virtual reality?
Well, for me, I had this sensation as a child after my mother died of profound isolation and loneliness. I had this sense of other people's heads being like the distant stars you can see at night, of these enticing, beautiful things, but too far to reach. You know, hundreds of thousands of years away by any reasonable, you know, approach one could think of. And I just wanted to somehow connect with other people. And I was really struck when I was a kid by art, and particularly I was into Hieronymus Bosch, the medieval surrealist, you know, and this notion that you could make these things that were from your head, not from reality, and other people could understand them. It was like this bridge. It was like the warp drive for me, this connection between myself and these distant orbs. And I've always thought of virtual reality that way. I've always been interested in this idea of finding deeper and more interesting ways of connecting between people. And so the way I imagined it is just as humans had evolved language as a way to connect, there would be this other new adventure where we'd make up experience itself instead of symbols about experience as a way to connect with each other. I used to call it post-symbolic communication, and that was my dream for it.
So you thought about it as a way to connect with other people in this very intimate way. Mm-hmm. Is that how everyone else thought about it at the same time?
Well, at that time, nobody was thinking about it. I mean, believe me, in fact, trying to explain what virtual reality was in the 70s was impossible.
What was it then?
Well, I mean, it was... there were a very, very few, very, very early experiments where you'd only see stick figure worlds in very expensive facilities and that did barely anything. But in the 80s, so I started my first VR startup in 84. Mm-hmm. And we developed the first sort of practical devices, the headsets you could...
You called it the iPhone, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
EYE.
EYE phone, yeah. Yeah, the first headset was called the iPhone. And in fact, when Jobs called his phone the iPhone with an I, it was considered by many people to be a little bit of a reference or an inside joke.
Huh.
I don't know if he thought of it that way, but I know other people in Apple did. But anyway, yeah, it was the iPhone, the EYE iPhone, and it was a pretty iconic device for a while in the 80s, and it didn't look that different from the sort of computer, consumer VR headsets that are on sale now. It was like a black thing with straps, you know, and you put it on your head.
But less graphically involved.
Well, you know, in those days, in order to sell a VR system, we had to, we would charge like $2 million per person. So they were quite expensive. And that's in the currency of the time. So it would be more now. So it was a very expensive kind of instrumentation. And it only went to the most elite government and university labs and corporate labs. It was a very special thing. But it had a market. I mean, it's where surgical simulation comes from. It's where vehicle prototyping comes from. All these things were prototyped originally on this equipment we sold. And it's true that even at that expense level, the graphics were not as good as what you get on ordinary consumer VR these days. We had these huge, like refrigerator-sized, roaring, specialized computers to make the images. But the funny thing is, though, that even though the graphics was less sophisticated, it forced us to work on the interactivity and what we call the haptics, the touch and feel. And I think that aspect actually was more sophisticated back then because it had to be.
Huh. Well, I'm Mary Harris. I'm filling in today for Leonard Lopate. I am speaking with Jaron Lanier about his new book, Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You are listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We are also available as a podcast. I'm Mary Harris, filling in for Leonard Lopate today. I am speaking with Jaron Lanier about his new book, Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You know, I want to ask you, what is virtual reality allowing us to do now?
Well, virtual reality has many lives. So the one that's been an unquestioned success has actually been around for a few decades, which is the kind of expensive use, not the kind that consumers see. I'll give you an example that touched my life recently in my family's lives. Back in the 80s, my greatest honor probably doing this was co-creating the first surgical simulator with a doctor named Joe Rosen at Stanford Medical. My wife in the last couple of years, I'm sorry to say, has been battling cancer, but she's, so far as we know, she's through it. I'm knocking on wood here in the studio. But her most elaborate of 7 surgeries was performed by somebody who was trained, by Joe, by my old collaborator.
Using the same system.
Using a procedure that was designed in virtual reality and that he trained for in virtual reality. So, and the procedure came out great. So the thing is, we've already had triumphs. We've already contributed in practical ways. But this whole wave of consumer virtuality really kind of arose again in just the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, we tried to get products out that were fun for people. We did a thing called the Power Glove a long time ago that some people remember, and a few other things like that. And of course, it's been in a lot of movies. It's been part of the science fiction vocabulary. But this consumer wave is a really interesting one. To my mind, it reflects the world at large. There's a lot of idealism and beauty, and there are amazing artists, there are amazing young artists doing incredible things in it. And then there's also a lot of kind of manipulative, creepy stuff, and a lot of just misguided, sterile stuff. It's just a mirror of the world at large, which I think is troubled in the same way.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the medical benefits. I was struck by an example you gave in the book about pain, about how virtual reality could be used to sort of potentially control pain.
Oh, yeah. That's so I don't know if she's listening now. One of my old student interns, who's now a professor at Cornell, Andrea Wan, came up with this, and I'm very proud of her work. And I want to really emphasize that this is preliminary and not yet ready for clinical practice, but the idea is that you're in augmented reality, or mixed reality was my term for it, where you see both the real world and virtual stuff, and people who have localized pain, like just pain in their arm, add a virtual tattoo or Band-Aid over where the pain is, with other people who validate it, and they see themselves with it in a mirror. And then over time, it gradually dissipates. And then some people find that little trick also makes their pain dissipate.
What I love about that is it just gets to the root of our human experience, which is so much of it is just about how you perceive it, how other people perceive you, and how important that can be to controlling your physical experience.
Yeah, I mean, virtual reality is really the medium in which we directly address how we perceive the world. Instead of creating new artifacts out in the world like language or paintings or movies for us to perceive, we're actually playing with our own sensory motor loop directly. And so it's potentially the creepiest thing, because it allows us to manipulate ourselves and each other's in a more direct way than with other media. But it's also potentially the most illuminating and beautiful thing. It can go either way. I of course hope it goes in the direction of beauty and illumination.
Yeah. I mean, you've said your two obsessions are music and virtual reality. And I guess I wonder how you think about those things as being connected, or if you do.
Well, to me, musical instruments are the only user interfaces that are really good that people have devised yet. You know, and so I can't imagine trying to understand the future of computer science, or much less virtual reality, without being obsessed with musical instruments.
How many instruments do you have?
Well, we don't know. some years ago, we did an inventory, and it was over 1,000. And before anybody says, oh, that's so interesting and impressive that he has that many instruments, I just want to make clear, this is a sickness. It's an obsession. I don't recommend this degree of instrument addiction, but nonetheless, I have it. So yeah, a lot of instruments.
I wonder if there's been a moment where you're playing and you realize something that informs your work in virtual reality.
Oh, all the time.
Like what?
All the time. Well, I mean, one that was really dramatic for me was when I was interested in how, when you learn to play the piano and you improvise, you're solving all these math problems just to figure out what voices will work. And I got people who could improvise well on the piano to try to solve the same problems just on paper or on a screen in other ways, and they were a lot slower than what they did on the piano. And so what I realized is that something about the piano was unlocking a kind of very quick logical cognition that we normally don't have access to. And that kind of thing, like finding these little windows into human capability, just thrills me. It's like discovering some new territory, you know, to explore. And I believe that sort of thing will be really important to our future. Ultimately, all computers can really do is help us use our brains better. They don't bring anything on their own to the table. They're just these kind of, you know, mindless devices. So what we really should be looking at is our own capabilities, our own potential, and to see where we can grow.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if your experience with music is why you have this idea that virtual reality can kind of deepen the way we communicate.
Yeah, music is kind of like virtual reality without content, but only form. You know, in music, you do this pure form sharing with other people and you make it up as you go. And I hope virtuality will feel like that, except instead of just this pure form, there'll be content to it too. You'll be making up worlds and new bodies for yourself and improvising all this with other people. And I know just saying that must sound like sort of a flaky thing to say, because how exactly would that work? And I, in the book, I go into at least a little bit of how it might work. But in truth, most of this will be for future generations to discover.
You talk a lot about the risks of virtual reality, too, and the risks of all technology. What should we be thinking about that isn't as great?
Well, I think the greatest danger is the combination of behaviorist manipulation using computers and addiction using computers, which is what we have right now with social media and other online platforms. And it's destroying the world. It really is. It's not survivable. The addiction part of it is...
Do you believe people can be addicted to computers?
Well, sure. I mean, that's not a question of belief. That's
the truth.
That's a question of replicated science at this point. I mean, it's not. The behaviorists discovered that you could addict animals and then eventually people to systems. And the way you do it, there are a few principles. One is what's called noisy feedback sometimes, where the feedback isn't perfectly consistent, but it's a little random so that your brain becomes engaged in trying to make a better theory. So if the rat presses the button and always gets the treat, that doesn't actually engage the rat as much as if once in a while it doesn't work, because then the rat's brain really wants to understand what's going on.
That is Twitter.
Well, you know, if you want to look to the digital world where you see people who've explicitly and knowingly adopted these lessons, online electronic poker, computerized gambling has really worked hard to optimize this. But Twitter, Facebook do it knowingly as well. Or at least Facebook has said they do it knowingly.
Do you have any social media accounts?
No, I don't. They're fake ones. You might see some with my name, like there's some real Jaron Lanier on Twitter or something. But no, none of them are me.
Yeah. What do you worry, too, about how corporations have become involved in this? I mean, you spoke about the beginning and this beautiful beginning and thinking about it being open and free for everyone. Where did we land now?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different power structures to worry about. And I think any particular entity getting too powerful is not a good thing. The corporations, I mean, it's a funny thing because I'm part of them. I mean, I do my work in Microsoft's research lab and I sold a company to Google. So I'm very much an insider. I'm not outside the walls throwing stones at all. And I think that's really important. You need to have a loyal opposition in order for any large power structure to be even remotely healthy, right? And it's totally doable. It doesn't make the world implode. I do worry about excessive power for some of the tech companies. I also worry about excessive power for some of the intelligence services. I also worry about increased power for information warriors from hostile governments. I also worry about organized crime. We have a range of different powers that have been... that just benefit disproportionately from the digital universe we've created, and it's not a healthy trend.
Well, I'm wondering. You say you're an insider. What happens when you have these direct conversations? You seem like a very direct person when you talk to people inside these power structures and say, "This is a problem."
Well, my hope is that it does some good, and I don't want to claim personal credit. Because I don't know, but I do think that when people like me, and I'm not the only one, talk about this, it does start to have some effect on the tech community. And I think we've seen it. I think we're seeing more and more people from the various companies say, well, maybe we shouldn't be knowingly addicting people. Maybe we should be more careful. Maybe we can't automate morality. Maybe we're working with the wrong incentives.
Yeah, you've said when people get scared, they get narrow-minded.
Well, see... Here's the problem. I talked about one aspect of making digital technology addictive, which is inconsistent feedback. Another one is what emotional fuel really engages people.
And fear.
The negative ones. Fear, anger, resentment, jealousy. All these negative things are much stronger than the positive ones. And they're easier to bring on. They're cheaper from a monetary point of view to fund, and they're easier to sustain. And so you have this system where the digital systems that are the most engaging tend to be the ones that are kind of bring out the worst in people. And to a degree, there's a precedent for that in yellow journalism and everything, but it's never before existed in this tight feedback, this algorithmic loop that so many people are stuck in. So can I say the saddest thing I'll say in this whole interview?
Please, I think.
The saddest thing I'll say is that, so far as I can tell, whenever somebody brings positive energy to the current online environment, and I'll give you some
examples. Give an example, yeah.
Arab Spring, when women tried to improve their status in the gaming world, Black Lives Matter.
Right.
In all those cases, that positive fuel was routed into negative energy because that was the most efficient and profitable way naturally to make use of it.
Give me an example of that. In each case,
what happened is that the people who were annoyed or fearful or whatever of these positive things were identified, introduced to each other, corralled, and then stirred up more and more and more in a pressure cooker because that was the most profitable and effective way to make money for the businesses. And it was also the most efficient way for somebody coming in as a customer to spend their money. They got the most results. So the Arab Spring turned into horrible terrorist networks. Women in gaming turned into Gamergate, which was this unbelievably vicious, nasty thing that was a prototype for the alt-right. Black Lives Matter turned into this resurgence and sort of normalization of racism, neo-fascism in the U.S. that would have been inconceivable a year before. And now here's the thing, the sad thing I'm going to say is Me Too is going to meet the same fate because it's so dependent on social media. I don't know what it'll look like, but in about a year, if the pattern holds, there'll be some backlash that instead of the normal sort of backlash we see in history will be something horrendous and vastly more powerful than the original. So we're used to this thing in history where when somebody agitates for rights or for a better society, there's always a backlash. But over time, there's this arc of history where we seem to be getting more decent. But since social media arrived, just the opposite happens. Every one of these things turns into a much worse result, and we end up going backwards. That's new, and it's structural, and there's no way to avoid it until we change the incentive structure of the online world. So that's the horrible, sad thing I'm going to say.
Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Oh, God. You know, I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist because I look at history and I see all the horrible things people have been through. And yet somehow through these horrible periods and horrible events, we seem to get it together. And we seem to gradually, over the course of history, become a little kinder to each other and a little more decent. And society is a little less disgusting. I really believe I see that trend in history. And so that's strong evidence we'll do it again. The present moment is a scary one, and it's hard for me to write the story in my brain about exactly how we get to where we are, from where we are to a better next step. But we've done it before, so I really believe we'll find this path.
You know, I have to say that when I read about your book, I really read it as a parent, and I know that you have a young daughter. It made me think about her and think about, like, how do you talk to her about this technology? I'm sure she has friends on Facebook and Instagram and all those places, and how do you speak to her as a parent?
Well, you know, in Silicon Valley, the higher up somebody is in the tech world, generally speaking, the more they try to insulate their kid from any of our products. So what I see is executives at the big tech companies putting their kids in Waldorf schools. I've taken a slightly different tack. I kind of feel like she has to learn for herself. And I feel like just trying to put a severe prohibition on things will just create a backlash, and she has to figure it out. Her friends' parents all work at, you know, places like Google, and most of them have very strict kind of anti-tech households.
Really? And like, what does that look like?
They just don't let their kids, you know, go online except in, you know, very limited and strictly supervised ways, and preferably not at all. They, like, the people who do this stuff really don't want their kids to be around it. And I just feel like I have to trust her to find her way, even though she's only 11. At what point does she start to make decisions? And I think that point has to be now.
Does she want access to this stuff?
Well, I mean, it's still a bit early. At 11, I think. So far,
my 9-year-old wants a YouTube channel, so not that early.
Yeah. I'm so far really pleased with the decisions she's making, but I really think it has to be about her and not about me.
I also thought about your childhood, which was so unconventional. And I just wonder what your experience tells us about how we create better digital citizens right now. Because, like, for instance, my kid, who I just referenced, like, he's going to school, he's learning to code, he's learning about being online. And I read your work and I thought, maybe that's like the opposite of what he should be doing. He doesn't need to learn how to use a mouse. He needs to learn something else entirely.
Well, all right. So there's a few things to say there. As far as what kids should be learning, we're kind of teaching them 1970s computer science right now. Like, learning how to code per se isn't really that relevant anymore. They should be learning how to train machine learning algorithms or something like that. And that hasn't entered into the general education stream. So I feel like we're teaching them the old stuff that doesn't really help them. So that's one comment. That's a big deal. That's an important issue. But then this other issue about, like, what do you do to make people better citizens? So my feeling is that just give them the option to be. Right now, the way the online world works, for the vast, vast majority of people, there's only one incentive they can seek, which is more and more attention. And if there's an environment where the only benefit you can get is attention, then it'll kind of bring out the ass in somebody, you know?
Huh.
You know, it turns everybody into a little kid looking for attention. Everybody's acting out. So I think if you can diversify the range of benefits people can get from being online, then you'll diversify the range of behaviors and make more room for people to be more decent. And as an example,
how do you do that? Like, I mean, and the whole structure is about attention right now. So
yeah, well, okay.
Is there anyone doing it now?
People are going to think that I'm biased because it's one of our things, but LinkedIn is a social network where all the fake news problem and the meanness problem hasn't happened. And the simple reason is that people have at least something else to think about than getting attention, which is furthering their career. So if you just put some other incentive in there, no matter what it is. I personally think the big mistake was demonetizing everything. I think somebody who has a lot of followers on Facebook should be earning some money from Facebook. They should get a royalty for making Facebook valuable. And I think people should actually pay a subscription fee to Facebook if they use it. I think it should be monetized, because otherwise the people who monetize it are the people we call the advertisers. But they're not like car and perfume companies, like TV advertisers. They're like the Russian intelligence warfare units. They're bad actors, because the money that disrupts society spends much farther than any other kind of spending, so we attract the worst people.
You said, though, the original idea was everything is free and open. Does that just not...
Well, if we could make it free and open, but also have it be in a context that isn't capitalist, that is plausibly, like, if everything was really going to be a socialist paradise, well, we could maybe that... I don't know. I mean, it's never...
You have to go all the way.
Yeah, you have to go all the way. It's the combination that's killing us.
Yeah, yeah. You seem to be advocating in your book that we resist the pack mentality.
Yeah. So I have this hypothesis that people are one of these species, wolves are another, that where we can either act as single individuals in the world or as members of a pack. And when we act as members of a pack, we form a hierarchy, we become vicious and paranoid of people who aren't members of the pack, and in general, we become worse. And so what we want to do is we want to incentivize individuals instead of packs. And I do think that the online world has tended to bring out a kind of a mob quality, mob dynamic. We even use negative language to talk about it. We talk about things going viral, you know, which is a bad thing. Viruses are bad. we've just accepted that this is the way things must be, but it's not true.
I guess I wonder, we're at this moment, you mentioned the Me Too moment and how you think it's going to flip around just because of what's happened in the last couple of years.
Right. Well, it's just the structure. Unfortunately, the structure, the incentive structure of the way the online world works.
So what should an individual actor, someone like me, be doing online to try today, who's, you know, thinking about this movement to do it better?
Well, I my own sense of what we should be doing is, first of all, not relying on advertising-driven channels for social activism. Above all else, you can do it online, but don't do something that's advertising driven. Find something that has some other business plan. Because if it's advertising driven, then ultimately that is the job of that platform. And ultimately the service of the advertisers is to find negative emotions, because those are the most engaging. So ultimately your opponents will receive more benefit than you do. It's a structural problem. You can't fight it right now. You could agitate for the platforms to change their business plans. I don't think an attempt to legislate and prohibit the addiction algorithms will work because it's hard to define them or detect them. Hmm. But I think I feel certain that if Facebook transition, say, over a five-year period to a monetized model where people pay to use it and also can earn their living from it if they do well on it, I think that would shut down the Russian spy masters and the mob and all the crazy abuses and all this stuff, because it'd be something else for people to do. I think that's all we need to create.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am Mary Harris. I'm filling in today for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with Jaron Lanier about his new book, Dawn of the New Everything. Yep.
Can I just say quickly, Maureen Dowd and I
was about to say
it. Oh, okay, go.
Tonight at 7, he's going to be speaking with Maureen Dowd at the Strand Bookstore. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.